From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Che Guevara is perhaps the most potent symbol of the revolutionary guerrilla. Each group that appropriates his image invests a different meaning in his story. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the myth of Che Guevara with journalist Patrick Sims, author of Chasing Che. Sims took a 10,000-mile motorcycle trip across South America, retracing Che's 1952 motorcycle trip. It was the trip that radicalized Che. And we meet jazz mandolinist Don Sternberg. We often play his music in between interviews. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton held a White House meeting today with top representatives of the computer industry to discuss computer security following a wave of costly vandalism on the Internet. Participants included Attorney General Janet Reno and a computer hacker and security expert known as Mudge. Spokesman Joe Lockhart said the meeting was designed to see whether the administration's thinking on computer security was on the right track. The meeting came as FBI experts examined a computer believed to have been used in last week's attacks, and the FBI sought at least three computer hackers for questioning. Vice President Al Gore's campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination got a boost today, winning the endorsement of the nation's largest abortion rights group. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League had been neutral in the Democratic race between Gore and former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley. NARAL leaders said they could live with either man as the nominee, but over the weekend, NARAL's board of directors decided to endorse Gore. Bradley has made an issue of Gore's changing stance on abortion. He once wrote that it was arguably the taking of a human life. Today, in accepting NARAL's endorsement, Gore said having a pro-abortion rights president would be crucial in the coming years.
An anti-choice president with an anti-choice majority on the court appointed by that president could completely reverse and overturn and do away with Roe v. Wade.
Bradley, meanwhile, got an informal endorsement from hundreds of Teamsters Union workers in New Jersey. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton has declared federal disaster areas in four counties in southwest Georgia. People in the region are cleaning up from a swarm of tornadoes that left at least 22 people dead and more than 100 injured. The White House expressed disappointment today at the news that the Irish Republican Army has pulled out of talks on disarmament in Northern Ireland. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
White House spokesman Joe Lockhart said the decision of the Irish Republican Army to pull out of the disarmament talks was an example of backsliding. The very thing President Clinton said he hoped wouldn't happen when the British government suspended the bipartisan Northern Ireland governing body last week.
The line between conflict and peace is very rarely a straight line, and we're going to continue to work this from all sides.
The president has spent hours on the phone with leaders from all sides of the conflict in Northern Ireland, urging them to live up to the Good Friday peace agreement. Part of that accord was a commitment from the IRA to begin giving up its weapons. But the IRA says the British government and the Northern Ireland Protestants have ignored its proposals on disarmament. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 198 points to close at 10,718 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In just 2 hours, the Republican presidential candidates will face off in a televised debate in South Carolina. Texas Governor George W. Bush and Senator John McCain have pledged to avoid negative attacks in their last appearance before a wide audience before Saturday's primary. Bush and McCain will be joined by talk show host Alan Keyes, who sought to keep the debate focused strongly on conservative social issues. Both candidates have used negative campaign ads in South Carolina, but have softened or withdrawn them when polling showed the candidates were hurt by their own ads. Federal prosecutors continue to build their case against a man accused of plotting bomb attacks in the U.S. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Seattle.
Federal prosecutors in Seattle are now seeking blood and saliva for DNA testing from Ahmed Rassam, a man charged with conspiracy to commit a terrorist act and smuggling explosives into the U.S. Prosecutors believe that Rassam may have burned himself while handling bomb-making material in his Montreal apartment. They're trying to match Rassam's DNA with DNA taken from pants and shoes seized from his apartment. Prosecutors believe recent scars on his leg appear to have been caused by chemical burns. In a separate matter, a Canadian woman who prosecutors originally thought might be linked to the bombing plot has been released, pending sentencing. Prosecutors in Vermont say Lucia Garofalo cooperated with investigators and has no knowledge of any terrorist activities. She's agreed to plead guilty to two immigration charges. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
President Clinton said today he'd consider more federal aid for low-income families who've been hurt by the rising cost of home heating oil. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been more than 40 years since Che Guevara led the decisive battle of the Cuban Revolution, the Battle of Santa Clara, which toppled Cuba's military dictator, Fulgencio Batista. Che was killed in 1967 while trying to create a similar revolution in Bolivia. His face still appears on T-shirts and posters around the world. His image is used to inspire rebellion and even to sell beer. My guest, Patrick Sims, is a journalist who went in search of the Che Guevara legend by motorcycling through South America, retracing Che's 1952 motorcycle trip, the trip that radicalized Che. Sims writes about Latin American politics and third world travel for such magazines as Harper's, Outside, and Wired. His new book is called Chasing Che. I asked Sims to tell us about Che's motorcycle trip.
I think he fell deeply in love with the south of Patagonia, which was one of my secret agendas in doing the trip. I had been down there before, and it's just such a shocking and green landscape and really beautiful. And he, he didn't really set out with any kind of political agenda. He just wanted to goof off. He wanted to see the world. He was 23 years old, and he and his buddy went down there, and they just totally fell in love with it. And he said in his diaries from the 1952 trip that that was the place he would like to come back to. That was the where he wanted to, you know, set up a medical practice and retire and live out his life. And I felt a very strong connection to that landscape. And when I read his diaries about it, I thought, you know, that's somebody who I think I could understand.
But by the time his 1952 motorcycle trip was over, he, I think, had changed his mind about setting up a practice and retiring in Patagonia.
Yeah, it radicalized him as he moved, you know, down through Argentina and up Chile and into Peru and began to see more of the poverty and the shanty towns and the, you know, he was traveling very, very rough, you know, living in leper colonies, sleeping in... You know, as a medical student, he'd sleep in spare hospital beds in yellow fever wards to save money. And he really had a sort of deep immersion in the full misery of 1950s Latin America. And it gradually began to radicalize him. And by the end of the trip, he was thinking of himself more as a more political person, as a somebody who needed to take action about what he saw.
Now, why did you want to retrace this 1952 motorcycle trip?
I guess I'd been struck by sort of the power of Che's image all over Latin America. I had spent a lot of time reporting in Cuba, and people there sort of hold him up as an example of what could have been, what might have been if he hadn't died. And, you know, there was a fellow once in Cuba who gave me a little picture of Che and said, if he were still alive, none of this would be happening. And there was that kind of attitude that, like, he was the lost, better part of us. Our dreams were lost when he died. And I wanted to try to understand where that came from and why people believed in him so deeply. And I guess I saw in his motorcycle diaries, his account of his trip, his own explanation for that, his own sort of origin point and where he felt he came from. And it was that notion of discovering a sense of solidarity with people all over the hemisphere, people who, you know, he'd grown up as an aristocrat in Argentina, and he wasn't necessarily the kind of man who would go out and identify with lepers or fight for the poor. And that was a real change in his life. And I think that travel opened those doors to him. It radicalized him. It made him aware of conditions he hadn't seen before. And it also, in a very personal sense, taught him to sort of live in motion. He talks in his diary about discovering that his destiny was to be a traveler forever. And his mother wrote to him later and said, you know, you'll always be a foreigner. And I think the travel sort of taught him to live never at home and to always be in motion and to be ultimately a revolutionary in a personal sense as well as a political one.
What do you think are the main things that Che Guevara did that gave him that iconic image of the ultimate heroic guerrilla?
Well, there's no denying he was very brave in battle. I mean, he led from the front lines. He was Fidel Castro's right-hand man, and they made their revolution in Cuba in 1957 and 58, a real battlefield revolution fought in the mountains in eastern Cuba. And Che was deeply respected by the men who served under him and loved because he had a kind of insane courage. He really believed in what they were doing, and he fought from the front lines. He was wounded, I think, 6 or 7 times. And he had a very charismatic nature and an ability to sort of not just be a battlefield tactician, but to explain the kind of moral terrain that the guerrillas were on and why they were fighting and to help convince people to join the revolution. He was very eloquent and a sort of, you know, after the fighting, he became a minister in the Cuban government, but he kept doing things like manual labor, volunteering, you know, to unload bags of wheat at the port in Havana. And so people kind of really identified with him as a very immediate living person rather than just some abstract figurehead. And of course, since he died, when he died in 67, that began to reverse, and he's become, as the decades pass, more and more of a sort of two-dimensional symbol, an icon stripped of that reality.
Did you meet a lot of people along the way on your trip who had either met Che or at least claimed to have?
Yeah, there were a lot in both categories. There were quite a few people I managed to turn up. I was very surprised who had met him. You know, when I was down in Patagonia, I just used his diary and went around and, you know, looked up the family names and so on. And I found a fellow named Oscar von Puttkamer who had been a small child when Che stayed in their house. I looked up Che's ex-girlfriend from 1952. I found a guerrilla in Cusco who had trained under him in Cuba. I even, at the end, went and looked up Che's traveling partner, who was a fellow who went on the entire trip with him and still lives in Cuba and is sort of in charge of curating the Cuban government's version of Che's life.
Yeah, in fact, you say the reason why this guy, Alberto Granado, went on the trip with Che is that it was Granado's motorcycle.
Yeah. They were sort of partners in crime in a way. They were friends. But above all, Alberto Granado owned the beat-up old Norton motorcycle that they were going to attempt to cross the continent on. And they got pretty far along. Eventually, Che crashed and destroyed the motorbike, but that didn't ruin their friendship. And they kept on by hitchhiking and being stowaways and, you know, riding on trucks and so on, in a very kind of slow, difficult travel over the Andes through Peru. And Alberto Granado is a pretty diehard defender of the Cuban regime to this day, but it was really interesting to talk to him and sort of sit there as two motorcyclists chatting about the towns we'd been in and how things had changed and what was and wasn't the same 44 years later.
How does his version of the 1952 motorcycle trip with Che Guevara compare to Che's diaries of that trip?
Well, I guess there's two differences. One is a fundamental sort of character difference between the two. Che, as he put it in his diary, set out for adventure. He called himself a dreamer. He wanted to go to the South Pacific and pursue South Seas maidens. And just, you know, he had no political agenda, really. He was a lark. Alberto Granado, who was a few years older than him, was already at that point a dedicated Marxist and tended to see things in very political senses. So they had different purposes and agendas in the trip. And in a second sense, I think Alberto Granado sort of edited his account in order to make Che look a little better than he was, and not necessarily in any important ways. There were just a series of small discrepancies between the two diaries. There was an incident at one point they volunteered as firemen in a little town in Chile because they were stuck in this town and there was a fire. And according to Che's diary, Alberto Granado rushed into this burning building and saved a cat. And according to Alberto Granado's diary, Che rushed into the building and saved the cat. And it can't be both ways. I don't know who's fibbing, but I got the feeling that not only were their political, their sort of personal agendas very different, but that the diaries, you know, reflect a certain amount of positioning of the sort of Che product in our contemporary culture.
Has Granado kind of made a career of having taken this motorcycle trip with Che?
Yeah, he gets a lot of status out of it. He's a, you know, a sort of friend of Che, as they called him in Cuba, somebody who knew him. That's a very high status position there. And he, you know, you'll see him at events in Cuba, you know, that when they're opening up a new golf course or something, they'll have a picture of him in the paper. And it says, you know, Alberto Granado, a friend of Che, tests the golf links. And I don't think that's something that ordinary Cubans necessarily get to do. It helps to have been a friend of Che.
Now, you mentioned you talked to a guerrilla who trained under Che Guevara. What did the guerrilla, the former guerrilla, tell you about Che?
I guess I was most struck by his sort of sense of great regret. He felt that he'd failed Che in a very personal way. He told me, you know, to me, Che was a saint, and he sent us, he trained us, and we failed. And I think I actually talked to a lot of ex-guerrillas on this trip, and just universally they felt a sort of great disappointment that their dreams had been false, that the revolution wasn't coming, it never had been coming, that they were mistaken. But even so, there was a great sense of loyalty in his voice to the man he had known who had inspired them so much. And Che was a really charismatic leader who sort of exerted a kind of personal influence over a whole generation of these intellectuals across Latin America, everywhere in Latin America. Dozens and dozens of guerrilla groups sprang up imitating him. Their leaders trained under him. There's some guerrillas still in the field today in Colombia who trained under him in 1963. And even one of their leaders even puts on the little beret and sort of strikes the Che pose and looks up for the photographers in exactly the same way as Che would pose, you know, trying to evoke that connection, that image of the past, and hold on to that, you know, what the Cubans call the heroic years, the spirit of great revolutionary change that was supposedly going to sweep over Latin America.
You say there are anti-communist groups that see Che as their hero, too.
Yeah, there's a even the Contras in Nicaragua would look up to him as a sort of a pan-theological guerrilla. It doesn't really matter what your ideology was. He was a charismatic guerrilla leader who shot his way into power, and that's the basic example. You find people in Argentina who were associated with the right-wing death squads and even leaders of them who claim to revere and admire Che. So the ideological differences no longer hold much meaning. There's this kind of universal agreement in Latin America and in many European countries as well that he was an inspiring figure who did, you know, made the ultimate sacrifice to speak for the poor and the disenfranchised. And I guess you find that the poor and the disenfranchised don't have a lot of spokesmen, so they're willing to take anybody.
Now, you met a lot of people who met Che or claimed to have met Che. Is there a story that you came to think of as the kind of typical apocryphal story about meeting Che?
Well, there are so many that were so startling and strange sometimes. I made a habit as I traveled along. I was on the road a long time, 4.5 months, about 10,000 miles. And I would feign ignorance. I'd say to people, so who's this Che Guevara character in the papers? You know, what's the story with him? And I'd get these just incredible tales that he was, you know, really a European or a North American, that he was, you know, Castro's brother, that he was a drug dealer, that he was, you know, any kind of crazy thing. You know, there were all these stories about he wasn't really killed. He's alive today in such and such place. Just the most fantastical accounts. Somebody told me he was a internationally famous car thief. You know, just things that made no sense at all. But again and again, people felt that some sort of connection to him. And I think it's because there are so few heroes in Latin America. There's so few people who even tried to speak up and do anything about the tremendous poverty. And you don't have to agree with his ideology to sort of notice the tremendous emotional power that his image has for people who are the down and out of the world.
My guest is journalist Patrick Sims, and he retraced Che Guevara's 1952 trip across Latin America and has written a new book called Chasing Che, A Motorcycle Journey in Search of the Guevara Legend. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Patrick Sims, and after retracing Che Guevara's 1952 motorcycle journey across Latin America, he's written a new book called Chasing Che, A Motorcycle Journey in Search of the Guevara Legend. Let's get to Che Guevara as a pop icon. I mean, there were souvenirs, I imagine, throughout Latin America with his likeness on it. Why don't you describe the range of souvenirs that you found?
I was nearly run off the road quite a few times by trucks that had Che Guevara mud flaps on them. I don't know the symbolism of that, but I'd be sort of hurtling off the side of the road as a truck passed with Che mud flaps. Cuba is the main place for buying Che souvenirs, but you can get them all over. You know, they make skis with Che Guevara's likeness on them, beer, cigarette lighters, nail clippers. T-shirts, of course, rock albums, Rage Against the Machine puts Che on their albums and flies Che flags at their concerts. I'm fond of, I bought a pair of Che maracas, which I really like to break out sometimes and play on.
Did you talk to souvenir vendors about what sold best and how the trends seem to change from year to year?
Yeah, I mean, far and away the bestseller, you'll see them, they're everywhere in Cuba now. Che tourism is one of the main props under the Cuban economy, and I think far and away their big seller is what they look for is Europeans who want to buy Che T-shirts, and you can see at any one place. I was just in Cuba a few months ago. You see 25 or 30 different varieties of Che T-shirts, and this sort of intense competition among the vendors, and then the international marketplace is no slouch, at exploiting his image either. Swatch produces a special line of Che swatches, which are only available. The Cuban government bought the entire production run and sells them for profit at Jose Marti Airport outside Havana. So everybody gets in on the act. It's a big cash generator.
The ultimate capitalist transformation of the communist revolutionary.
His ex-girlfriend said to me, "It's just too ironic. He's become a consumer item."
Now, Che Guevara transformed himself. Tell us something about his family background.
He was the motorcycle journey really changed his life and his world. He was born into a kind of aristocratic family in Argentina. They didn't have a lot of money, but they're very intellectual and educated. And he went to medical school and never practiced as a doctor, but he had a kind of a noblesse oblige. I think his mother was a very amazing character, a beautiful, wealthy woman, a political radical who raised him to be very independent and filled their house with, Spanish Civil War veterans and artists and writers. But they didn't have any money, so he also grew up, he was in street gangs when he was a kid and was at a sort of rough and tumble childhood and knew that side of the world as well. And he also, from a very early age, suffered from terrible asthma, so that his whole life was kind of a physical challenge, and I think that's crucial to understanding him. He had what's sometimes called the asthmatic personality, which is reacting against the feeling of suffocation, against the feeling of weakness by polishing your will, your willpower, and always fighting on, and he was just incredibly rugged. I came away from that motorcycle trip with a sort of deep respect for his physical toughness. He had to keep going. He had to keep pushing, even when it was desperate. And he probably believed that they couldn't succeed. He still fought on, and he ended up dying in a very squalid way at the end of a failed mission in Bolivia, but unwilling to ever quit.
Patrick, when you were, spending 16-hour days on your motorcycle in rainstorms and feeling quite despondent, What got you through it? I mean, unlike Che Guevara, you don't, to my knowledge, have asthma. You're not the asthmatic personality. You weren't a revolutionary in the making. Did you ever say to yourself, why am I doing this?
Yeah, all the time. But, I mean, one of the great lessons of the trip is it's amazing what you're capable of when you have no choice. I would have things like, I had a terrible accident in deep, deep southern Chile. I have no idea what happened. I just woke up in the side of the road with a motorcycle on top of me and a broken rib. You know, I was in the middle of nowhere. There wasn't a single other car around. And what do you do in that situation? You get up and you go on. You have to. It's not like there was any choice. Again and again, I'd find myself in places and experiences where I was very vulnerable. There was nothing to do but trust people by the side of the road. And again and again, I found that those people always came through for me. I was sort of shocked at how good human beings turn out to be, because people could have taken advantage of me over and over again in any kind of situation, when I had breakdowns, when I was, you know, sleeping in strange villages in the middle of nowhere. Between not having any choice at the worst moments, and between that sense of wanting to live up to the sort of good treatment I was receiving, I found it kind of necessary to keep going and keep pushing on and keep trying to, in the end, reach Bolivia and see the final things he saw, the places where he died, the places where he fought and died.
Well, on the lighter side, one of the things you learned from Che Guevara was how to freeload. After reading his diary, you decided that when it came to freeloading, Che Guevara was a prince.
Yeah, I'm a little ashamed of it, but I'd traveled a lot before I started on this trip. I'd even hitchhiked across South America once, and I'd sort of incorporated the notion that when you're on the road like that, you're living out of a backpack, you're far from home, nobody knows who you are. There's a kind of a glancing quality to the life, and it's very tempting sometimes to, you know, as Che would do, fabricate these stories about who they were and just kind of throw themselves on the mercy of people. It's very easy to sort of become rude and just insist that people take care of you when you don't have any resources and you're far from home. And he was a champion at catching free meals and drink off people, getting into parties. He was always in search of liquor. And I used to study up on his techniques and use them. You know, like I got into a firehouse one time, and Che had this whole technique of refusing to have a drink unless someone would give him food. So if someone offered him a drink, he wouldn't drink it. He'd just leave it sitting there until they got insulted and said, "Why aren't you drinking?" And he said, "Well, you know, in my country, we're used to having some food with it." So then the person would buy him some food. And I didn't really believe that would work until I tried it, and it worked perfectly. So there's a lot of things you can learn from Che.
Patrick Sims is the author of Chasing Che. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Industry Standard and thestandard.com, providing today's business executive with intelligence on the internet economy. On the web at www.thestandard.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You may recognize this recording. We often play it on the show. Coming up, we meet the man behind the mandolin, Don Steinberg. And we continue our conversation with Patrick Sims about his motorcycle journey in search of the Che Guevara legend. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Patrick Sims, author of the new book Chasing Che, A Motorcycle Journey in Search of the Guevara Legend. It's about the motorcycle trip Sims took across South America, retracing Che's 1952 motorcycle trip. You went to the place where Che Guevara's remains were secretly buried, and then they were in 1997 dug up and taken to Santa Clara in Cuba, where he led the decisive victory against the Batista regime. Tell us a little bit about your visit to the place where his remains were secretly buried.
That was the end of my trip, and I got in there. I just finished about 10,000 miles. I was about 4 months into the trip, and I was just utterly exhausted. And it's this sort of brown, parched landscape in southern Bolivia, very desperate, these tiny little hamlets. And I got into town, and immediately on my arrival, because I was the only gringo there, a fellow from the local radio station interviewed me about who I was and what I was doing here. And unbeknownst to me, that interview was broadcast over the entire province. So the next day when I set out, you know, in this very remote area to go try and see Che Guevara's, you know, where he fought his final battle, where he was killed, where he was buried, as I drove down the road, villagers would come running out of their huts saying, "Hey, you're the gringo on the radio." And, you know, I talked to Che Guevara right on this spot 30 years ago, right here. And he told me this and that. And you never quite know whether to believe those stories because there were so many of them. And I think people get very excited about having a connection to him. But I'd sort of, wherever I'd go, I'd be confronted by people who'd heard me on the radio and wanted to argue about Che Guevara's doctrines and ply me with moonshine. And it was a very funny and odd end to the trip. You know, you'd bump into these European Che tourists who had Che tattoos sort of wandering through this landscape. And it was just a surreal place and very grim and sad. But in the end, the villagers sort of, it's the most exceptional thing that ever happened to them there. And they sort of look back on it all kind of fondly.
Were Che's remains still buried there when you were in Valle Grande?
Yeah. During the course of the 4.5 months that I chronicle in Chasing Che, they were searching for his remains. And so it's a constant theme in my book about the sort of the search for this phantom remains. In the end, they actually did find them. He was buried in this vast valley. You know, they sort of found most of his remains. And there was a very sort of ugly necrophiliac argument between Argentina, Bolivia, and Cuba over who got the remains. And eventually Cuba won, and they were exported to Cuba and put on display, and there was a very grand funeral there, which I attended, and he's now a sort of official museum exhibit in the Cuban Revolution.
Well, as you point out, in Cuba, Che Guevara is part of the establishment.
Yeah, it's funny. When you get to Cuba, and a lot of places elsewhere in Latin America, he's a leftist symbol, but in Cuba, a lot of people who are dissatisfied with the regime also exploit his image, and then he's at the same time, you know, if you walk into a Cuban school, you will see his name on the blackboard. His picture is in every school I've ever been in Cuba. His face is everywhere. He is the official patron saint of the revolution. His lessons are taught to children all through school. Toddlers literally nap under his gaze, and every child in Cuba takes the pledge, "We will be like Che." So he's got this sort of twin nature as a kind of the establishment, a symbol, you know, an official propaganda symbol whose face is 7 stories tall on the side of buildings. But at the same time, he's used in a kind of subversive way by the dissidents within Cuba who think he represented some more humane trend in the revolution, a more hopeful and noble and personally sacrificial kind of leadership than they have now. I think people are exhausted in Cuba, and he symbolizes those hopeful early years, what they call the heroic years.
After you completed your motorcycle trip, retracing Che Guevara's trip, you came to the conclusion that Che Guevara was a brutal man.
I think that's been sort of washed away with the forgetting of the years. I mean, his life's work, he was a very inspirational man, a charismatic leader. He gave a lot of beautiful speeches. But in a lot of ways, his life's work was setting up ambushes and was teaching others how to conduct, you know, recon. He was a soldier. He viewed himself as a sort of intellectual soldier of fortune fighting in the socialist cause. He directly trained and led or inspired or directed guerrilla movements across Latin America and in Africa. He was personally a violent man. He you know, when they were in the mountains of eastern Cuba and he was with Fidel Castro, they caught their first traitor, a guerrilla who'd defected. And Castro said he has to be killed, he has to be sentenced to death. But no one would volunteer to do it except Che. And I think that he believed in a very kind of harsh world. He believed in violence. He said, violence is the midwife of the new societies. We mustn't be afraid of a little violence. And that, too, was his legacy. Everywhere I went in Latin America, I saw the scars of this tremendous epic of decades of violence and guerrilla warfare. And it's not all his fault, but he did his very best to increase the violence, to polarize the climates, to try to train people to use violence to be a midwife of the new societies. And the cost for that was incredible. It's a continent covered with mass graves, with fresh scars. And that, too, has to be part of his legacy.
Of course, his violence was fighting against violent regimes. There was already a lot of violence in Latin America.
Yeah, he didn't step into an empty world. I mean, he was reacting against a very legitimate kind of constant repression. I mean, for example, in Cuba, the conditions there before the revolution were awful. And people rallied to their cause and responded to the guerrillas and joined them and were willing to sort of liberate themselves under arms. But he tried to export that model to make it apply in places like the Congo and Africa, where he backed a guerrilla army that fell apart, or Bolivia, where he believed he was coming to liberate these peasants who, you know, were living under oppression, and indeed they were brutally poor and still are. But the peasants didn't welcome him. They turned on him. They ratted him out to the army because they didn't know who he was. They viewed him as a meddlesome outsider. And it was easy, I think, to extrapolate too far from the example of the kind of liberating Cuban Revolution, which really was a legitimate middle-class popular rebellion that needed to happen, and then to try to export that to societies where there was a lot of repression and there was a lot of violence, but that ultimately adding violence, you know, adding, as many of the guerrillas told me, their own efforts simply made things worse. Jacobo Timmerman said all the guerrillas achieved was to grease the wheels of the killing machine.
Che Guevara was considered very, very handsome, very rugged looking, and that certainly has helped his iconic status. Do you think he would have kind of reached that iconic status if he looked more nerdy? or just you know, like less macho and less attractive.
I think it's true that some of his power today comes from the fact that he was a very dashing fellow, and that was always the case. Even when he sort of rose to be a battlefield commander in Cuba, it was partly his eloquence. It was partly the sort of dashing figure that he cut. And a lot of his sort of worldwide image today rests on a single photograph that was taken of him one day in 1960 in a beret, sort of his eyes burning off into the future. And, you know, it was an image that sort of caught a sort of fiery look in his eyes. And you can't underestimate the power of that image as a symbol. Even when, you know, the reality of Che Guevara, whether he actually looked that way or not, you know, isn't necessarily what determines whether people care about him. He is a symbol. He is two-dimensional now. And the angle of the beret, the length of the beard, and the fire in his eyes all contribute a lot to that.
Well, Patrick Sims, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Sims is the author of Chasing Che. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Coming up, jazz mandolinist Don Steinberg. This is Fresh Air. Don Steinberg is a mandolinist who was described in Mandolin Magazine as either the finest jazz musician to ever play mandolin or the finest mandolinist ever to play jazz. Steinberg was the protege of Jethro Burns of the famous music and comedy team Homer and Jethro.
Stenberg performed with the Jethro Burns Quartet and played on the last two albums Burns recorded before his death. Stenberg's first recording as a leader is also the debut CD from the record label Blue Night. We often play music from it in between interviews on Fresh Air, so we decided it was time to meet Stenberg. We invited him to join us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago, where he lives, and we asked him to bring his mandolin to demonstrate a couple of things. But let's start with a track from his new CD, About Time. It features Kurt Morrison on guitar, Jim Cox on bass. This is Falling in Love with Love. Dan Stenberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
Few jazz musicians play mandolin. Is the instrument particularly well or poorly suited to jazz?
Well, I think it's really well suited to jazz. And you can think of the mandolin as sort of a cross between the violin and the guitar. It's the pitches are the same as a violin, but you play it with a pick like you would a guitar. So I think it's as well suited to jazz as those other two instruments are. You can do a lot of different things with it.
It has almost a more metallic sound than a guitar, and I think it has a lot less sustain than, for instance, an electric guitar. You know, a lot of jazz musicians play electric guitar, and they could get a nice sustained note. What do you do to compensate for that lack of sustain?
Well, the strings are in double courses, so there's only four pitches on the mandolin. But the strings are in pairs, and what that does is make it possible to do a tremolo. So the sustain on our instrument is the tremolo, which is a good thing for a nervous guy like me. So we can sustain notes, we just have to achieve it in that way.
Hearing you do that, I think of a lot of really, like, bad mandolin restaurant players. I hear Arrivederci Roma in my mind.
Oh, sure. Yeah, one of my favorites.
Oh.
No, you said right. Bad. Okay.
Did you learn to do a lot of corny stuff like that when you were learning mandolin?
Yeah. Things happen to you when you're a mandolin player, and that's one of them. You know, you tell people you're a mandolin player, and then pretty soon you're playing Italian tunes. The Godfather theme comes up quite a bit.
Oh, sure.
Of course. Those are wonderful tunes, though. They're great too.
Uh-huh.
They help build the technique on the instrument.
Right. How did you end up studying mandolin?
Well, the mandolin kind of came to me. My brother plays guitar and banjo really well. He's older than I am, and so I sort of appropriated it. And I was trying to learn it on my own for a good while. And then my mother heard an ad on the radio, study mandolin with the great Jethro Burns. So she sent me down to meet Jethro. And that's what really got me serious about it. I got really excited when I heard him play in person and wanted to learn to play like he did.
Now, Jethro Burns was half of the country comedy team of Homer and Jethro. What were they most famous for?
Oh, they had a really long and great career. Most people might remember them for a series of Kellogg's Corn Flakes commercials, where they would tell corny jokes and do routines, play a little music on the commercials. But also they were in all the major television shows. They did about 40 records, and I guess their claim to fame comedy wise was parodies of hit songs. They started out writing parodies of country songs, Hank Williams tunes, and things of that nature. And then later on, they moved on to just parodies of anything, Frank Lesser songs and just pop tunes of the day.
It was actually a surprise to me to read about and then hear what a good player Jethro Burns really was, because I always just thought of him as a really corny comic. In fact, why don't I play? You were on his last two records. You were his student, mm-hmm. and then recorded with him, performed with him. I'm going to play something from one of his last sessions. And this is a recording of I Can't Give You Anything But Love. You're featured on rhythm guitar with mm-hmm. Jethro Burns on mandolin. That's Jethro Burns on mandolin with my guest Don Sternberg on rhythm guitar, and Don Sternberg studied with Jethro Burns. Don, did Jethro Burns teach you the kinds of things he was doing on that track that we heard? Is anything that we heard on that track kind of distinctively Jethro Burns to you?
Uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of it was a good representation of his style, I think, and he would show me things of that nature. Mostly he taught me tunes, mm-hmm. and we would just get together and learn this, what he called the standards, and jazz tunes that, of his day that work really well for improvising with.
Well, can you demonstrate some of the stylistic things that he showed you?
Sure. The main thing about Jethro's style of mandolin playing was that he would use the whole mandolin. He was a great single line player, as you heard on that last I Can't Give You Anything But Love, but also he would play in a style that he kind of invented, chord melody style, where he could play a tune rather than one note at a time. He would play it four notes at a time. Jazz guitar player might play chord mm-hmm. melody style.
Mm-hmm. Must have been very gratifying for you to play on his last sessions. Do you think he had a sense that these would be his last sessions?
Oh yeah, that's kind of why they took place. He knew that he had limited time. He had cancer, and he still felt well enough to play. And so he and his family decided that it was time to have him play and record as much as possible of, play music the way that he wanted to play it. So I got the call to kind of help him with that project. We recorded about 70 duets at his house. Did some at my house too, but I guess most of them at his house. And we'd just go in the basement and play favorite tunes until he didn't feel well enough to keep playing, and got quite a few of them down.
My guest is jazz mandolinist Don Steinberg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz mandolinist Don Steinberg. Let's hear another track from his CD, About Time. This is I'm Coming, Virginia. Don Steinberg on mandolin from his CD About Time, which is, by the way, the first CD on a new label called Blue Night. That is just really a delightful track, and helps me realize what it is I like about your playing. I mean, you just have this really nice sense of time, very relaxed.
Well, thanks.
Which is something that I think you don't hear that much in mandolin, because there aren't that many mandolin jazz players.
Right. There's... Well, there's, you know, four or five of us now that I can think of, but, you know, compared to other instruments, it's definitely a small number.
Mm-hmm. The mandolin has such a smaller fretboard than the guitar does. Does that make it any easier or more difficult?
Well, the size of it isn't so much a factor as the way that it's laid out. At least to my way of thinking, it's easier to deal with because it's tuned to the same interval all the way across the mandolin. So when you learn one set of patterns for scales and chords, then you can just move that around up and down the fretboard, and it's a little bit less to keep track of than, say, on a guitar.
So it's more like logically arranged?
That's it, exactly. It's symmetrical, in fact. So that makes it a little bit easier for me to hear something and then play it on the mandolin than on a guitar or some other instruments.
When you started playing mandolin, was it hard to find a place for yourself in other people's bands? Most jazz groups aren't looking for a mandolin player.
Mm-hmm. I've always been able to find places to play, but quite often I'm playing other styles of music too, especially early on. I played in a bluegrass band as was my first professional work.
Have you been able to make a living playing music, or have you had to have day jobs also?
No, I do make a living playing music.
What kind of settings do you mostly play?
Well, I play other instruments, other string instruments, as I mentioned, playing guitar quite often, and I also play tenor banjo, which is really like a big mandolin, the same sort of tuning system. And I play fiddle and country bands from time to time. So I'm kind of like, you know, I'll play, most of the time I'll play in jazz bands or bluegrass bands, and sometimes in country bands and also society bands here in town.
Now, you sing as well. When did you start singing?
Well, again, it's on that list of things that I started looking to do to try to help keep the calendar filled, you know, as a working musician. I used to sing harmony parts going all the way back to the Morgan Brothers, the first band that I was in, so I've always enjoyed doing that. And then as far as singing as a featured singer, that's been more just in the last couple of years, kind of following suggestions from friends about that. I'm a little bit reluctant about it, but trying to sing some of the jazz standards that I love.
Well, why don't we close with a track from your CD, About Time, that will show off your singing and your playing. And this is If I Could Be With You. Don Steinberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And thanks for playing for us as well.
It's my pleasure.
Don Steinberg's CD, About Time, is the debut CD on the Blue Knight label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
If I could be with you, I'd love you strong. If I could be with you, I'd love you long. I want you to know I wouldn't go until I told you why I love you so. If I could be with you for one little hour tonight, if I was free to do all the little things I might, telling you it's true, I'd be anything but blue. If I could be with you,
for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House and its Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Losing Julia by debut author Jonathan Hull. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of a boy who was raised as a girl and what that tells us about gender. We talk with David Reimer, who was surgically altered to be a girl after a botched circumcision destroyed his genitals. We'll also talk with John Colapinto, author of a new book about this now famous medical case study. Join us for the next Fresh Air.